Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you feel about roaches and spiders and maggots and lice? Many of us are repulsed to at least some degree at the thought of sharing space with these creatures, and some of us would be downright terrified to do so. But have you ever wondered why? Most bugs are incapable of doing us much, if any, direct harm, and yet we find them simultaneously distressing and insidiously fascinating. My guest today has spent years trying to understand the reasons for our strong reactions and for his own. Jeffrey A. Lockwood is professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming. His new book is called The Infested Mind, Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. And he joins us from the studios of KUWR at the University of Wyoming. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you had earned a very distinguished reputation as an entomologist, which might cause people to figure you would be completely immune to any kind of insect freakout. But then you found yourself swarmed by grasshoppers.
Yeah. It was a very strange and surprising and obviously sort of a long-term disturbing kind of an event. I'd worked with grasshoppers for many years and in many contexts, and I had this encounter in the field one afternoon. I had descended into a draw, kind of a gully, where there were enormously high grasshopper numbers up on the uplands. Maybe 30 or 40 per square yard. So that's pretty many. But they had really concentrated in this draw. And so as I descended in there, I encountered probably between 100 and 150 grasshoppers per square yard. It was just sort of like a living carpet, and they just flew up in every direction, began to bounce off me, clinging to my hair, clinging to my shirt, clinging to my clothing, crawling inside my collar, inside my shirt. And I think the technical term is I lost it. I had what psychologists recognize as a panic response. It really surprised me, although, you know, at the time you're not surprised. You're just feeling sort of this pure unmitigated panic.
Yeah.
And I sort of scrambled out of the draw and my heart was pounding. And, you know, I just had this sort of full-blown physiological response. And I was hoping it would go away. And it faded. But, you know, the memory of it stuck with me, and it became kind of stuck in my psyche, I suppose. My mind was infested, and I had to figure out what had happened.
Well, it's a really remarkable – I'm sorry that happened to you, by the way. But it's a remarkable way to sort of launch this discussion, because we all know rationally that most insects can't hurt us. Most of us, you know, we're obviously much bigger than they are. Most of them do not, you know, can't kill us with their bites or stings. How universal is our discomfort with insects?
Well, it's actually surprisingly common. There's been a number of studies that have looked at the fear of insects, both sort of a pathological fear, which we might call a phobia, as well as sort of an incipient fear, not something that is debilitating. And a very large percentage of the population has a negative response to insects. And this cuts across cultures as well. So it seems not to be something that is necessarily exclusively found in the United States or even in Western culture. Although Western cultures tend to have a more negative response, non-Western cultures also have frequently a response, but it is more likely to be a positive rather than a negative response. But we all, as humans, tend to respond to insects, yes.
What evolutionary reason would there be for us to be so very cognizant of just the presence of insects in our proximity?
That's a good question. It appears that insects in our evolutionary history have been pretty darn important to us, and they've been important in two ways. Certainly some insects are capable of inflicting pain. So we, you know, even as kids, we get stung by bees or wasps, and we have a pretty vivid memory of that. And over the course of human evolutionary history, not only the stinging insects, but, you know, things like poisonous spiders. You know, we're probably living in caves and shelters that would have supported those. And our bodies have been infested throughout most of our history with lice and various other vermin. So all of those are sort of on the downside. On the upside, though, a lot of human cultures still and over history have always made use of insects for food. And so I think we're very attuned to seeing or being aware of insects in our environment, because in our evolutionary time, it either meant an invader or a snack, depending on the context.
So one of the things that seems to bother us about insects is the way they move. What is it about those motions that triggers our revulsion?
Oh, that's a great question. That sort of skittering motion that catches our eye. And you know, some people have suggested that it represents to us a kind of escape or aversion, a kind of guilt or hiding, right? Mm-hmm. So that when something is trying to escape from you or to hide from you, that's a good reason to be suspicious of it, I suppose. Others have actually suggested that rapid movement, this is going to sound a little weird, and it sounded weird to me, but I'm just reporting, that rapid skittering movement actually resembles the rapid movement of the environment when we're falling. And so when an object moves suddenly out of the corner of our eye, we get a sensation of falling. That seems like a bit of a stretch. My suspicion is it has a lot to do with rapid motions out of the corners of our eye being important in our evolutionary history, and insects certainly have that. So while the insects skitter, the snakes slither, and both slithering and skittering seem to be a way of getting our attention.
I was a kid who played with a lot of bugs. They didn't particularly bother me, but I remember living in the Northeast when there was an infestation of Japanese beetles. And if you've ever touched one, you probably are familiar with them. You can't really shake them off once you get them on you, and that was really freaky.
Yeah, it's that clinging thing. I mean, insects have a number of these qualities or properties that are really capable of eliciting this kind of fear response. You know, and one of them is this capacity to give the sense of invasion, right? Mm-hmm. That they're clinging, that you can't get them off. I mean, quite frankly, the spiky, spindly legs of the grasshoppers that were clinging to my hair and my body, you know, kind of bring back to me that sense that you had with the Japanese beetle. They really become entangled in us, and that sense of being invaded is very much an aversive kind of thing. You get it off me is sort of the expression you hear.
It's ironic that the better the job we do at constructing homes and businesses and spaces that are sort of insect-free, the more bothered we are by the one or two that manage to make it out and catch our eye.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, I do think there's this evolutionary story to be told, but I don't think it's the whole story. I think a lot of our reaction in modern day to insects is cultural. And, you know, let's face it, most of us are urban, and most of the insects that we encounter in an urban environment, which is very hygienic, right? We've eliminated virtually all wildness. The animals are all, I mean, how wild is a pigeon, right? So the animals we encounter, especially in our homes in an urban or even a suburban setting, tend to be invaders. They tend to have a negative connotation. So most of our encounters, say in the big city, are, you know, with mammals, are going to be with rats and dogs and pigeons, and then of course the cockroaches, bed bugs, and their ilk. So we've sort of constructed an environment where the only things we let in, we don't even let in. The only things that get in are those that are highly adapted to living with us, and those are species that, because they're highly adapted, tend to be very furtive, very good at evading us, very good at infesting in our homes and finding our food. So it's not surprising that what we're left with is are things like, you know, cockroaches and earwigs and other things that we find particularly repulsive, because we work so hard to keep the living things out of our lives, which is rather ironic, isn't it?
And then we tell ourselves crazy stories like earwigs. I grew up believing that they really would crawl in your ear while you were sleeping and you'd never get them out again. That's apparently not what they do.
No. Earwigs aren't actually named for their tendency. I don't think they have a tendency to hide in people's ears. Although, you know, you hear these stories in of emergency room visits, and I gather they're all true. You know, of cockroaches crawling into kids' ears and moths getting into people's ears. I've heard that. And once you get a moth or a cockroach in your ear, you know, that's probably
hard to forget.
Fairly life-changing.
Well, talk about this. You have a great treatment in the book of our panic over the bed bug thing. And you know, I have not dealt with this problem personally, but I can understand why it would be upsetting. But they're not life-threatening. They don't really carry disease. They just kind of make you itchy. So talk about, you know, what you finally concluded that our discomfort is with these specifically.
Well, you know, I thought about this quite a bit because I've got several friends and acquaintances who have encountered bed bugs and you know, we even have them here at the University of Wyoming. As cold and dry as it is out here, we get them in the dormitories and whatnot. So they're reemerged in American culture, and I was trying to decide what is it that they're tapping into. And I was reading some work by a very good scholar, Jeffrey Weinstock, who had written about vampires, and I started reading about vampires and the way that they've infused Western culture in all of these fascinating ways. And he names these various qualities of vampires, and I was reading along thinking, gosh, those are all the qualities of a bed bug.
Hmm.
So first of all, bed bugs are in our bedroom, right? And so there's a kind of invasion of our private space, a place where we're vulnerable. There's a kind of sexualization of the vampire, and it's in our bed that we find the bed bugs. They feed on our blood, right? That you wake up with spots of blood on your sheets in the morning, and that's pretty darn freaky. It's like they never die. You hear people about with their infestations, and it's you know, for weeks and months, every time they feel anything, you know, at night, they panic and think the bed bugs are back. And so, and they are, in fact, very, very difficult to kill. And like vampires, the way that we end up finally defeating the bed bugs, at least temporarily, is through technology and expertise. We don't, of course, we don't use anti-vampire techniques, garlic or whatever the heck it is. But, you know, we use heat and of course pesticides turn out not to be very effective at all. And of course the really freaky thing about bed bugs in some ways is not only do they live in our beds, do they come out at night, they feed on our blood. They infest us at these intimate places and times. They're also just weirdly other, you know, alien and foreign. That's a quality sort of insects that while they are animals like us, they certainly have some features that make them seem phenomenally other or terrifyingly alien in some ways.
I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about, you know, we can understand, you know, we tend to find birds appealing, mammals sort of resemble us in some important ways, but we're not freaked out by fish the way we are freaked out by insects.
Well, you know, we tend not to be freaked out by fish, although if you go fishing with somebody, and of course, I guess a fish at the grocery store isn't really very freaky. But there is a kind of an interesting disgust factor. And of course, fear and disgust are related emotions, but they're not the same. I've taken people fishing and my kids fishing and whatnot, and fish are pretty darn slimy. And there's a kind of mucousy sliminess to fish that when you handle them is, you know, has this kind of disgusting quality to it. You kind of want to get beyond the slime and get into the meat pretty quickly if you're a fisherman.
My guest is Jeffrey A. Lockwood, professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming. His new book is called The Infested Mind: Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey A. Lockwood, professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming. His new book is called The Infested Mind: Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. You can be part of the conversation at think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We have a tweet here to @ChrisBoydThink from Ryan, who says, "One insect may not be so bad, but a horde or swarm of anything is terrifying. That generates most of my insect fear." Talk a little bit about what's behind that, Jeff.
Yeah, I think he's touched on something important there, and that's that sense of being overwhelmed. And that taps both into a sense of fear and sometimes a sense of disgust. And you know, you were mentioning that we're not very afraid of birds and fish, but of course Alfred Hitchcock did that wonderful thing or that terrifying thing with birds, and there was a kind of malevolence there, but a lot of it came just from their sheer numbers, and when we. And at least for me as well, it's that sense of being overwhelmed, of being suffocated, of being sort of minimized. Your own sense of identity in these sorts of overwhelming situations. I remember as a kid, my father had his dissertation advisor had moved to Colorado and had a telescope built on top of this mountaintop, and I remember looking through this telescope into the stars for sort of the first time as a kid, to a really decent telescope, and it was terrifying as well as fascinating. This sense of the depth, the number, the size, the scale, the enormity of the universe really rushed in on me, and it was both terrifying and fascinating at the same time. So, if stars can do it, then I guess it's not surprising that insects and birds can do it.
What is the relationship, you mentioned this before, between fear and disgust?
Right. It's generally taken to be that there are either 6 or 7 universal emotions. And 2 of those are what we call aversive emotions or negative emotions. And those are fear and disgust. And they really are kind of related in the sense that we don't want them. We don't want whatever is around us that generates them. But there are some important differences. Fear generally has to do with our immediate physical well-being, and the usual response to fear is to try to escape. Now, with disgust, it's also an aversive emotion, but really what's going on there is a response to the possibility of invasion or contamination, or sometimes said to be excess. But basically, it's the idea that that we will become contaminated. And what's interesting is that while fear is found in many, many different species, a number of the primates exhibit fear, only humans are capable of disgust, it appears. And until we reach a certain age, young children up to the age of about 2 don't seem to exhibit disgust, as anyone who's been a parent can readily attest.
Yeah, toddlers will eat bugs without blinking an eye.
Yes, yeah. And, one of the most common parental, messages is put that down. You don't know where it's been, right? And which really means put that down. I know where it's been. So, disgust is something that comes later in our development, and some of that is probably because infants, given their bodies and whatnot, if they were to become disgusted, they probably would never survive. And later on, we teach what a child what is disgusting. Although again, there are cross cultural features of disgusting objects, things that are slimy and slippery and then have a possibility of getting inside of us. Mm. And disgust also tends to be triggered by much more close proximal sensations. We're disgusted by tastes and smells and touches. We tend to be fearful of sounds and sights. And so there's kind of the 5 senses divide up a bit in terms of disgust and fear as well.
Is disgust contagious the same way that fear can be?
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's contagious as well as it's taught. And it's not always really easy to determine whether there's a contagion of the feeling of disgust Some psychologists contend that you can only be disgusted, in a sense, by your own personal encounter with something. You can close your eyes and imagine something that's disgusting, but you don't really get the feeling of disgust. Hmm. You get a recollection of what it was to be disgusted, but you're not, you know, genuinely disgusted. With fear, it's much easier to sort of close your eyes and recall a fearful encounter and to get all the full-blown responses that you had at the time.
At what point does discomfort with insects cross the line into phobia?
Yeah, it's a difficult line to distinguish. Basically, a phobia is taken to be something that has the qualities of a persistent, excessive, and unreasonable fear. So, if it has those three qualities, we're probably looking at a kind of a phobia: persistent, excessive, and unreasonable. And when it comes to entomophobia or a pathological fear of insects, studies suggest that up to 6% of the U.S. population experiences this at some time in their lives.
Hmm. I was really interested in the demographic differences that predict one's susceptibility to phobia. I had no idea that those existed.
Right, right. It's quite interesting. You know, if you want to predict who's going to be afraid of insects, one of the things you want to pick out is women. There's much higher level of entomophobia as well as many other phobias in women than there are in men, although there are some studies that suggest that men tend to underreport their fears. And, you know, if you tell them they're hooked, it's great. If you hook them up to or pretend to hook them up to a lie detector, right, and then ask them whether they have fear and what they're afraid of, their reports go way up. So men are, you know, tend to mask their fears, and culturally men are not supposed to be fearful. So you have that whole gender thing that's going on sociologically. But it does appear that women have higher rates of fear. Some ethnic groups have higher rates of fear. Education may be a predictor of fear, although it tends to have an interesting phenomenon in that generally, with greater education, you're less fearful. But ironically, there were some studies that showed that students who have had a biology course actually are more likely to be afraid of insects than those who haven't. So so maybe sometimes ignorance is bliss.
So, or maybe that speaks to the idea that we're at once sort of repulsed and fascinated by some insects.
Yeah, I think that is an important feature. And it's always been an important feature in my life, is this sense of, I mean, even early on, you know, when I first got into entomology or when I was a kid feeding grasshoppers to the black widows living on the back wall of our house in Albuquerque, there was a combination of being pushed and pulled. And sometimes this is a phenomenon that's associated with the experience of what we call the sublime, to be sort of drawn towards something but then repulsed at the same time. It's a really weird sensation. But it's very powerful, this push and pull kind of sensation that you get around an insect, where you want to get closer, you want to get a really good look at it, but at the same time you don't want to get very close to it. It's really a fascinating thing to feel in oneself or to watch in another person.
And of all the diagnosable mental illnesses out there, it turns out phobias are some of the easiest, or they are some of the most successfully treated on a permanent basis. And yet many people who suffer from them would rather just sort of stay away and not encounter, especially exposure therapy, which is often the standard protocol.
Yeah, yeah. There is kind of a paradox of what we call simple phobias. Or these phobias that are based on a sort of a single stimulus. And that is, especially entomophobia, is very easily diagnosed, which means that there's diagnostic tools out there that are very reliable. And it's also oftentimes treatable in one or two or three sessions. But the problem, I think, is that what we do is we tend to work around our fears, right? So we just don't go into the basement. We don't look under the kitchen cabinet. We don't move to Florida, right? Or maybe to Texas. I don't know. Because a lot of these simple fears are relatively easy to sort of work around in our lives, there's people who won't fly and they take the train and whatnot. But the problem is, or the frustrating thing is, the treatments. You know, we hear about exposure therapy. I guess it's been on some television shows and whatnot, and it looks pretty dramatic and whatnot. But really, the most effective therapy that's out there is not a straight exposure therapy, but something that's called cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's not traumatic. It's not dangerous or threatening, and it's not magical and mystical. It's actually a very systematic and in the hands of a fine practitioner. It's something that is very reliable in terms of being able to move people in sort of a rational, experiential way out of their phobia and into presumably what's a more fulfilling and happy life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Doug in Rockwall. Hello, Doug.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you, Chris?
Great, thank you.
Good. I have two questions, actually. I read a book several years ago by a scholar named David Landes. It's The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. And the thrust of the book is, he's an economic historian. He talks about the poverty or wealth of nations as a function of geography. And in there is a chart of the 12 or 14 deadliest diseases known to man. They're all contained within the tropics. There's African sleeping sickness, malaria, obviously. And, I told my kids, they were young then, I said, we won the lottery just by being born in a temperate climate because we don't have to deal with these things like folks do down in the tropics. My question for your guest is this, to what extent are we winning the war against these insect-borne tropical diseases? Is the tide turning to where it's no longer a concern like it was, for instance, when we built the Panama Canal? And that's my second question. We lost a good number of men working on the Panama Canal at the turn of the 20th century. Are we still calculating loss of life as an economic cost to projects because of insect-borne diseases? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. Those are a little off topic of the book, Doug, but maybe, Jeff, you have some insight on it.
Yeah, I think it actually is. It's a very interesting question in the sense that one would think that if we had developed fears in proportional to risk, what we ought to really be panicked by is mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Right? Not tigers and not lions and not lions and tigers and bears. but really, it's mosquitoes that have probably taken more human lives in human history than anything else. So what we ought to, when a mosquito lands on us, we ought to go nuts. While a cockroach probably ought not to have much of an effect on us at all. And this is one of the objections that's been raised to some of the evolutionary psychology behind, claims that we are evolutionarily predisposed to be afraid of insects, is that we fear the wrong darn insects. Hmm. But some of that's probably been overlaid with culture. And, of course, Doug is right. The insect-borne diseases have taken a tremendous toll on human life. African, sleeping sickness, malaria, yellow fever, and we did have a sense in this country, and I think this is fed in going back to your bedbug question. I think we had a sense in this country for several decades that insect-borne diseases were something that happened to poor, backwards, illiterate people. Right? That gee, our technology in the West, we had defeated such. Primitive and unhygienic sorts of things. We were beyond the insect-borne diseases. And then what do we have? Lyme disease, right? And here we've got a tick-borne disease. And I think that hit us pretty hard, right? It was like, wow, so this could happen here. And then we have this huge outbreak of bed bugs. And so the idea that U.S. society, Western culture, technology had defeated the insects and insect-borne diseases was a relatively short period of misguided arrogance. We are susceptible to these insects and not only insect-borne diseases, but insect damage to our food system and everything else. So the idea that we beat nature was a fairly short-lived victory in terms of what's really happening in the world.
To what extent do you think the presence of insects is a kind of reminder of our own mortality and the fragility of our bodies after we have died?
Yes. I think that's a very important consideration. I think that touches on some of the qualities of the insects which are capable of evoking this disgust response, because disgust is generated by a number of features of insects, and certainly one of them is the notion of death and decay. And so there's not many things more disgusting than for me simply to say maggot.
Right.
All right. And then, of course, you know, the insects are harbingers of death. We, you know, in our poetry, we have things like the death head's moth. It's been used. The insects have been used in literature as sort of this. And they also, as you kind of suggest, they bring up this reminder that, you know, despite all of our technology, all of our cleverness, et cetera, you know, we're animals, right? We're made of meat and things want to get inside of our bodies. And we can't stop them. And so insects are a reminder that we're animals, that we're mortal. Insects are also very promiscuous creatures. they have sex just anywhere. And so they remind us of our bodily functions. You know, in some ways, I suppose insects are for those of us without children, and I have children. They remind us of all those things: our own mortality, our own animal nature, our sexuality, hygiene, all of these features that we want to imagine for one reason or another that we're beyond because we're technological humans rather than bestial humans.
Do you know the Edgar Allan Poe poem, The Conqueror Worm?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, that and of course the classic in terms of evoking, you know, fear is Kafka's Metamorphosis, mm-hmm. right? What happens if we become insect, with all of their repulsive qualities and all of their features? So, not only literature but film has done a fantastic job of tapping into our fear of insects. You know, just think of The Fly. And the remake of The Fly. And I understand that there is even an opera called The Fly. I've not seen that. But that's on my bucket list.
Jeffrey A. Lockwood is with us. He's professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming. We're discussing his new book, The Infested Mind, Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. If you'd like to talk about your fear, loathing, or love for insects, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call, send email, rather, to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Jeffrey Lockwood joins us this hour from the studios of KUWR at the University of Wyoming, where he is a professor of natural sciences and humanities. His new book is called The Infested Mind, Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jeff, to go back for just a minute to Kafka, I think that's such a fascinating story because it really is about our fears that if the rest of the world could see what we actually are and who we actually are as people, how you know, revolted they would be by us. And that also would seem to be a universal fear that is maybe just parallel to the fear we have of insects.
Yeah, I suppose in a sense that's a sense of being, how shall we put it, psychologically naked or bare,
yeah.
right? As opposed to physical. And I think in both senses, what we become terribly anxious over is the sense of being violated, our sense of boundaries being violated or being broken. And they talk about, the psychologists talk about fear and disgust, particularly disgust, as a violation not only of a physical barrier, that is something gets inside of us physically, but even a violation of a psychological barrier, something getting inside of our mind, inside of our psyche, inside of our emotions.
What drew you to study insects in the first place?
Ah, You know, I think it was this sense of the sublime. Even when I was a kid, I had this both a fascination and kind of a fear of not so much a fear. It was sort of this a fascination tinged with darkness. And I do remember, it's going to sound kind of strange, I do remember catching grasshoppers when I was a kid. And we had built a house at the edge of Albuquerque and had a cinder block wall. And the black widows had colonized, all of the throughout the wall. And we'd go out there and in the afternoons and go feed the grass and go feed the black widows. and it was, as a kid, it was the idea of predation, right? And and praying mantises just utterly fascinated me as well. I had a praying mantis that for many weeks, actually for most of a summer, I think, that I kept and I fed it, small grasshoppers and flies and whatnot. There was something just totally fascinated about them. And I think what it comes down to was my being sort of enchanted by the alien, right? These things were, of this world, obviously, but they were just so different than me in terms of their behavior and their body and their way of making their way in the world, that I was enchanted.
Insects are interesting as well because there's no, unlike almost any other creature, we don't feel like we have any way to relate to them or communicate to them what we might want them to do. We can think that even about something, as sort of small-brained as a reptile, but somehow we can't imagine communicating with an insect.
I think that's right. I think it has a great deal to do with the nature of their bodies. And some of our intuitions about not being able to communicate with them are pretty much spot on. They tend to be much more tuned into, say, chemical communication, right? And which plays a very relatively small role in our lives. And although the predators are particularly well attuned visually. Insect hearing is just a whole different phenomenon in some ways than oftentimes occurring at different frequencies than us. And so we can't even get the message in. And it's very hard to interpret them as well. Snakes and birds and these other vertebrates, when we encounter them, we can pretty quickly judge, right, whether they mean us harm or whether they are frightened of us and whatnot. But with an insect, it seems almost in some ways disdainful of our presence.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back on the phone now to Oliver in Plano. Hey, Oliver.
Hi, Chris. Good afternoon to you and your guest.
You too.
I just wanted to let you know I've been bitten by a black widow, a scorpion. And then just recently I went into anaphylactic shock. And the fire ant bit me.
Oh.
And I'm not afraid of the little buggers.
Really?
In fact, I've studied them now because I need to get to know them a lot better. Hmm. And I just want to take your guest comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Oliver points out that even though, as you pointed out, Chris, at the sort of the top of the show, that most insects are just plain harmless. There are a few insects, and we'll throw the spiders in there. They're not insects, but they're close enough, at least in our mental sort of sphere. There are some that will do us harm, black widows and spiders. Black widow spiders and, of course, scorpions, which are another group of arthropods, they can inflict a great deal of pain. And I did my graduate work at LSU down in Baton Rouge, so I can attest to the pain that can be inflicted by fire ants. Hmm. Those are fairly despicable creatures. Once they've covered your lower leg and have begun their biting and stinging. So, yeah, insects can inflict these sorts of pain. And what Oliver points out, which is really encouraging, is that he's replaced fear with wanting to learn. And I've worked doing research in my book. I worked quite a bit with a beekeeper, and that was sort of his approach, is that we can replace our fear with knowledge. And when we know about the insect and we know its habits and we know its potentials and we know its ecology, then we needn't be so fearful because it loses some of that alien quality. It becomes something that's familiar and even kind of friendly or engaging. So I think Oliver's onto something there. We oftentimes our fear is rooted in ignorance.
Yeah, I really liked the bee section, and I was surprised to learn that, like, the extent to which Americans polled overestimate how many among us are allergic to bee stings.
Yes, yes, we. It's a very small percentage, and I'd have to sort of dig back through that part of the book. I think we estimate that about half of everybody is allergic to bees and is likely to go into anaphylactic shock and whatnot. And of course, it's a very, very small probability that that will happen to you, which is not to downplay a seriousness for those who are allergic to bee stings.
But it's like 1% or something.
It is. Yeah. And we estimate far higher than that.
Hmm.
So we in a sense talk ourselves into our fears, and again, going back to Oliver, you know, some of that is rooted in our own ignorance. We scare ourselves.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I think Oliver started the point that I wanted to make, is that as a gardener and an organic gardener, I can't go out and nuke the bugs in the garden. I need to learn which are beneficial and which are problems, and then decide if I treat the problems, am I going to kill my beneficials?
Hmm.
So I do a lot more hands-on than I ever would have thought possible years ago, pulling things off of plants. I wear gloves, but hornworms are big and wiggly, and a lot of the beetles and things that are out there, to me, it's a sign that the yard is healthy, that they're all out there. I am interested in how every year there's some new bug that comes along that I haven't seen before, and I have to always be learning new things. So I'm interested if the entomologist part of you has an observation about life cycles or how they keep doing that to us.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, Maggie, you know, again, this touches on this other chapter that's in the book, and what, you know, the most of the book admittedly, you know, begins with fear and loathing, but it does finish with loving. And this whole notion that's emerged in sort of nature psychology, which is called biophilia, or as applied to insects would be entomophilia, the love of insects, does have to do with the things that Maggie was touching on. This fascination, this understanding that insects can be beneficial, they can have these sort of utilitarian virtues. They're aesthetically pleasing. In fact, they're beautiful, and they play these important roles in our culture and in our story, positive symbolic roles. Even the cockroach has been used as a positive symbol in some literature as a kind of icon of sociopolitical defiance. And of course, from the scientific or entomological perspective, the insects are virtually bottomless resource of intellectually stimulating sorts of inquiry. We don't even know the names of the majority of insects on the planet, let alone what they do and how they make their lives in this world. And so they are an untapped resource for fascination, for science, for beauty. So there really is a tremendous amount of upside to this sort of alien among us, but it takes a kind of humility, and certainly a kind of respect for something different than ourselves to really engage them. But I do think it's very possible for us to shift. Although there will always be those among us who have fear and fearful encounters, I think as a culture we can shift at least in the direction of entomophilia, or at least in the direction of tolerance. I think that would be satisfactory in many ways.
I wonder if you can talk about hypocrisy here. I will out myself, and I will say that I'm probably not alone, but I will go out of my way to ferry a spider out of my house safely on a piece of paper to the backyard, mm-hmm. but I will stomp a cockroach and I will go after a wasp nest in the backyard with a vengeance. And I realize that's kind of ridiculous, but we also are hypocritical about, you know, we love ladybugs and butterflies, but we hate other things. Why do you think we allow ourselves to make these categories of insects? In some ways, it's a little bit arbitrary, isn't it?
Well, it is a little bit arbitrary, not entirely. I suppose, you know, all things considered, the spider in your house. As a matter of fact, I, at one point I used to ferry them out. Now I think they're lovely to have around because they're probably keeping the house relatively free of earwigs and whatnot. So a few spiders in the basement, let them be. They, you know, they're good neighbors. You know, of course, there are spiders that one needs to be concerned about, and discerning them can be very important. And that's actually one of the things that you know, maybe at the root of our apparent hypocrisy, and that is our we're not particularly well trained or versed or educated in naturalism these days, and we just have lost the ability to distinguish various kinds of insects, even whole groups of insects, let alone the beneficial from the harmful insects. And so, you know, to give ourselves a little bit of a pass, we've not done a great job in education in terms of getting our children to the point where they can understand the natural world and which things are and which things are not worrisome. And so what happens, I think, is that the default position is that if I don't know anything about it, it's probably something to step on. And I think that's where we end up with the hypocrisy, is because the few things that we know about, we tend to be much less fearful of. But since we aren't able to distinguish different kinds of insects from one another, our sort of knee-jerk or our root response is to squash it.
That sure is a remarkable metaphor for the struggles we have with prejudice in our human interactions, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know, maybe it's stretching it a little bit too far. But, you know, at one point in the book, I advocate, of course, every book has to invent a new term. So I invent the new term entomoapathia, right? And so there's entomophobia, which is fear, and there's entomophilia, which is love. And I end up advocating a kind of benign neglect, right? So not everybody has to go out and love insects, but I think we at least want to cultivate a kind of tolerance. And insects are wonderful organisms. They're alien and they're different, and they're a great way for us perhaps to have our children practice the tolerance of difference. And who knows, if they get well practiced with cockroaches and spiders and ladybird beetles and whatnot, maybe they'll be able to extend the practice of tolerance to other kinds of people that they don't understand at first, to differences that might otherwise be fearful because of a kind of ignorance. And so I think cultivating an acceptance of the natural world is kind of translatable into cultivating an acceptance of a diverse human world.
And by and large, a lot of insects actually have a role to play within a healthy environment, as Maggie alluded to, whether we understand individually what that role is or not.
I think that's right. Now, while that's true in the vast majority of cases, again, it's kind of a practice of discernment. A house overrun with cockroaches is not a pleasant or healthy place to live.
Right.
But a yard with some aphids and some, you know, and some flies and some butterflies and a few caterpillars, as she's describing this sort of biological diversity in her garden, that is a healthy garden. That is definitely a healthy garden. If a swarm of locusts descends and strips the garden down to the soil, then Maggie's got a problem.
Jeffrey A. Lockwood is professor of natural sciences and humanities at the University of Wyoming, where he joined us today from the studios of KUWR. His new book is called The Infested Mind: Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. Jeffrey, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.